So good morning. I would like to call to order the regularly scheduled meeting of the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy. Today is April 6, 2016. We will begin the meeting by having members of the board introduce ourselves as well as our staff members so that you'll know who's at the table. And then we'll actually go around the room and ask you to introduce yourselves as well. As a reminder, please sign the sign-in. It's somewhere in the back, but before you leave, please make sure you sign that so that we'll know who was present. So I'll begin. My name is Daphne Bernard, board member.
Good morning. James Appleby, board member.
Good morning. Eddie Curry, board member.
Tamara McCants, board member.
Good morning. Alan Friedman, board member.
Good morning. Benjamin Miles, board member.
And staff present.
Good morning, everyone. Shauna White, executive director.
Good morning, Latasha Geck, Health Licensing Specialist.
Good morning, Carla Williams, Board Counsel.
So let's go around the room, and if you will, we'll start with this nice gentleman here. If you could just state your name, and if you're affiliated with any organization, state that as well.
Reginald Bellamy, Pharmacist Inspector.
My name is Alfred. I'm doing my intern here.
Hello, everyone. My name is Roland Jackson, attorney for Dr. Shadow.
Don Zuar, DC Public.
I'm Denise Beluca, District Manager of Walgreens, Washington, D.C.
Hi, Jennifer Thomas with Del Norte Foundation.
Daniel J. with Walmart.
Hi, Renita Abadaz of Howard University College of Pharmacy student.
Good morning, my name is Kishore and I'm a pharmacy student.
Good morning, Jonas Terry, pharmacist with the Department of Healthcare Finance.
Aditario, pharmacist at Safeway.
Joe Rubino, CVS Health.
My name is Stanford,
Katie Patel, South Carolina student.
Heather Frey Maxor.
Diana Reed, DOE Tasca, Keith Ada.
Good morning, Mary Beatrice, pharmacy student at Howard University.
And I know you just walked in and you're about to get comfortable. Can you just state your name and whatever organization you might be affiliated with?
Yeah, hi, I'm Charlene Fairfax. I'm the senior pharmacist with the Department of Healthcare Finance here in D.C.
Thank you. Welcome to you all. So we have a pretty packed agenda today. We're going to try to keep it moving. We'll start off by having an approval of our open session meeting minutes from February 2, 2017. So board members, if you've had an opportunity to review those minutes, we will entertain a motion whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair, I move that we approve the public session minutes from February 2nd.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Is there general consensus in favor of the motion?
Yes.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries. So now we will begin with our executive director's report. She will provide the licensing update.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome, welcome, welcome on this cheery morning. Currently we have 1,833 pharmacists licensed in the District of Columbia. We have 560 pharmacy interns. We have 137 pharmacy technician trainees. We have 730 pharmacy technicians registered. We have five pharmacy technician training programs. We have 1,109 pharmaceutical detailers, and of our pharmacists, we have 495 that have the vaccination and immunization authority. So I want to thank all the pharmacists who renewed their license in a timely manner. I want to encourage everyone to make sure your information online is up to date. Also, wanted to make a quick announcement. On our website, we have a link to our newsletter through NABP. We've sent that out to everyone. However, if you want to get on that email list, you can register your email address with NABP and they can send that newsletter out to you directly.
Thank you. Next on our agenda is our Assistant General Counsel's report. Please.
So my first item is the pharmaceutical detailing emergency legislation. And I really just wanted to bring that to everyone's attention, kind of FYI. As you may recall, previously there had been some discussion about a law that the council had put into place where it said that there was an exemption for detailers who were here for less than 30 consecutive days per calendar year. It was determined by the Attorney General's office at that time that that meant it was a one-time period that you were in the district, and if you did not go past 30 days, you did not need a license. Since then, council was lobbied, I assume, by pharmaceutical industry to have that language removed with the consecutive. So now it just says 30 days per calendar year. So that's the interpretation they were espousing at that time. Consecutive meant that that wasn't correct, but with the removal of the word consecutive, it now means that as long as you don't go beyond 30 days per a calendar year cycle, you do not need to be licensed in BC in order to engage in pharmaceutical detailing. That was passed as an emergency bill in January, which is set to expire today. They also enacted a temporary legislation, which is supposed to take effect. It says the projected law day is tomorrow. Once that takes effect, it will be in place 225 days, and then it's up to council whether or not they wish to enact permanent legislation keeping that in place. Assuming that they do, the board needs to decide how and what, if anything, you want to do, how to regulate that, because you have individuals kind of coming in D.C. very fluid, and how do we know where they are, and if anyone is going beyond the 30 days. So we may want to put some sort of regulations in place to help the board be able to continue to do its job, which is to regulate the profession. So it's something that we need to take a look at and to determine how to approach it, and it might be appropriate for our subcommittee to further vet that law.
So if I understood you correctly, the board has a couple of things to take into consideration. One, we can either do nothing, or two, we can try to frame some kind of structure around how we might regulate the detailers who may be in, because that will be a bit challenging, you know, looking at how often a person is here in the District of Columbia. So, any comments?
I need a motion to refer to the subcommittee.
I've moved that the board ask the legislative regulatory subcommittee to consider the implications of the new pharmaceutical detailing emergency legislation and determine what, if any, regulatory actions should be recommended.
Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion. If I could, just for clarification, so currently I know it's set to expire today, but there's something in place that's given an extension for how many more days?
So the temporary legislation, once it takes effect, will be in place for 225 days. The projected law date is tomorrow, the 7th. It really just is congressional day, so it may not be tomorrow, maybe early next week, but that would only be a lapse of a few days.
Okay. Any more discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries. Thank you.
Okay, and my second item, the LGBTQ regulations. This is really FYI to let everyone know that those regulations, which will implement the requirement under the new law that all health professionals obtain at least 2 continuing education hours every renewal period in courses related to LGBTQ populations and interactions with them. That regulation was published for public comment, and it will end on April 15th. So if anyone wishes to comment on that, please do so before April 15th. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next item on the agenda is our legislative subcommittee report.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
So just to refresh everybody's memory about collaborative practice, the Board of Pharmacy, the Board of Medicine, both have agreed with the latest draft proposal. My understanding is it's been circulated for, and Carla, correct me if I'm wrong, is it legal sufficiency and also perhaps the department was looking for some feedback in terms of the board's responses to the public, why we made the changes we did and why we did not incorporate other changes that may have been asked for. Is that sort of where it is at this point?
So it's still on the first step, which is it goes through the director of the Department of Health. So at that level, the director, we did provide the little chart that had all the comments,
right.
But we did not have the rationale in there for the comments that were not adopted. So it was sent back for those comments to be added.
Okay. So I know when the Board of Pharmacy met early on in the process, we did create a document that articulated the reasons why. The board did articulate the reasons why or why not. The board did indicate why we made the changes we did and where we didn't make changes, why. Now, I know we had subsequent meetings to that as well, so hopefully that information was captured. So I guess I'll ask Shauna.
Yeah, that information was captured, but I think they still want additional information. So
okay.
We're working on trying to get them the additional information that they come.
So do we have an anticipated timeline of, so if we're waiting for them, that's one thing, but I don't want the process to be held up because they're waiting for us. So what's our deliverable timeline?
I think probably in the next few weeks we can get it done. So definitely I would say probably by the end of the month we should be able to definitely, it should get up there before then.
By the end of this month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so once they receive that feedback, Carla, how many more steps do they have to go through? I'm just wondering if realistically, so this is April, so our next public meeting is June, so you're shaking your head no, so, okay.
This is step one. So from there it goes to the deputy mayor's office, the mayor's office, then it goes for legal sufficiency at the attorney general's office, then it goes back to the mayor's office, and then it would be published and registered for public comment. So anywhere along the line, someone can come back with more questions, feedback, so forth. So
let's talk ideal, that both agencies that are responsible for promulgating the regulations are in agreement, assuming we provide all the documentation by the end of the month for our reasons. What do you think the best case scenario is if everything sails through those various steps unencumbered?
I think we'll definitely have it by the August meeting. I think June is working.
Okay. So that's where we are in collaborative practice. Okay. Second thing is, I'd like to just float an idea out for the board members and particularly for those that are on the legislative and regulatory committee. So we've been meeting now for a few years, Dr. McCants, Dr. Appleby, myself, Carla, and Shauna, and thinking now we have a new board member, Dr. Miles, and the board members are all either participating on the Regulatory Legislative Committee or the Communications Committee. And I was wondering if you might be agreeable to serving as a member on the Legislative and Regulatory Committee. It sounds like the Communication Committee is now full steam ahead. They've got an agenda. They've got a work plan for how they want to provide information. And I think we're all really happy about that. I think it would be great to get the hospital perspective on regulations. It's something that's lacking, and we saw that clearly when we tried to promulgate the regulations for collaborative practice. So we held a special hearing. And along that line, though, we can't have more than a certain number of members present in a meeting because then it becomes a public meeting where we have to provide 30 days notice and so on and so forth. And these meetings are somewhat informal. So my thought was that perhaps you would join our meeting, and then between Dr. McCants and Mr. Appleby, we would sort of alternate. And I know Dr. McCants said she'd be willing to step back to allow you to join. Mr. Appleby and I talked last month, and he said he's happy to support either way, and there may be certain topics where one is more of a subject matter than expert, so we can kind of round robin just to make sure we have the number of people that we need to have a meeting, but not more than we need. Does that make sense?
I'm definitely willing to, if there's anything that you need my input on, especially from the community pharmacy perspective, and of course I'll actively participate on the board, when
right.
the legislation comes to the board. So
right.
if there's anything you want to run by me before you bring it to the board, I'm happy to still do that.
That would be great. So is that something you're
able
to? Okay,
yeah.
Great. So my thought then is that perhaps we start a regulatory review of the Board of Pharmacy regulations. It's probably been several years since a lot of the original regs were put in place, and the practice environments maybe have changed, and it would be nice for the board to make sure we're up with the times. So whether we start from the beginning and work our way through, or whether we perhaps identify the top 10 and sort of carve it out that way, I'm open to whatever the committee wants to do. And maybe the first order of business would be for the subcommittee to get together and talk about what approach you want to take. And then again, we can share information with the alternates all throughout between meetings and get input. We just have to make sure we have, you know, the right number of people at the table for the conversation. So does anybody have a different thought about the need to sort of take a look back at the regulations and make sure that they're as current as they should be?
I don't have any objection to that. I just want to remind the committee that we have regulations for the clinical lab folks that the board needs to regulate that we do need to implement. We should actually be moving forward to licensing and registering them. So I think we've been waiting on Vega to appoint our advisory committee, but I think we have some progress.
We do have some progress, and some potential folks still need a few more committee members for the advisory committee.
We're at least a year or two past that law being enacted, so that would probably have to be moved up on the list to get those rates in place so that those professions can start being licensed and regulated.
So as a courtesy to the members of our public and even maybe some of the newer board members, can you share the background on how that came about? Because we have been waiting for a while to get an update.
The background on how it became under the Board of Pharmacy?
What is that you're talking about with lab? I think people probably don't know about that.
Sure. So it was enacted, I want to say about two years ago, that all the professions like phlebotomists, clinical laboratory folks will be licensed or registered and regulated by the Board of Pharmacy. To help us, since it's not actually a part of your profession, it was put in there that we would have an advisory committee that would help us to create the regulations, but we've been waiting for them to be appointed. So there's about what, five or six professions on the board?
But the advisory committee has to contain certain types of people with certain levels of experience, so it's a little difficult recruiting. So that's what we're working for MoDA to recruit.
So do you anticipate then that once this group is in place, they would come to the legislative and regulatory subcommittee and sort of talk about, how do you envision them guiding the committee?
They'll have to work with the committee, and those will just probably be public meetings because we'll be open.
Okay, I mean, that would be good, yeah. Just so we make sure we're doing the right things for the right reasons.
Right.
Along those lines, how do generally boards work with advisory committees?
The board that has the most advisory committees would probably be the Board of Medicine, and typically, depending on what they need from them, they get the input from the committee, and almost like our legislative and regulatory subcommittee, we make the recommendation back to the full board for the full board to take the action if they agree with it.
Okay.
And as a follow-up to that, do I understand that when can we begin on the implementing regulations? Do we need to wait until Vega finishes appointing these committees?
Yes, we do need their input. I mean, we could start without them, but we do need their input.
So can we decide if we're going to start without them or not? Because it could be that the legislative subcommittee could accomplish a fair amount of work prior to the actual appointment of this advisory board, unless you have word that it's already been completed. Sometimes things don't move as that quickly.
I know Sean has been in communication with them. I don't know
get a few more members, so they're actively looking, so people have to put their application in and apply through, MoDA. Mayor's Office of Talent and Acquisition. So I'm in constant, communication with them about that, so they get resumes for all advisory committees, all mayor appointed committees, so just trying to have them reach out. So we're trying to reach out as well through other avenues to make sure we can get the people with the specific requirements to fill those positions.
So it may be possible to start with something else and then just once that committee's appointed, change gears.
Fair enough. So should I make a motion then that we adjust the composition of the legislative emergency subcommittee Benjamin Miles, and depending on the nature of the regulations being reviewed, either Dr. McCants or James Applegate will be a third member. That's what motion one?
Yes.
Okay. Does that sound all right?
Yeah,
to you?
I'll second the motion.
All right, so there's a motion that's been made and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Can I just ask a question?
Oh, sorry. Yes.
I heard some mention about there are a number of different groups that you're going to now be either licensing or regulating. You had mentioned phlebotomists.
Yeah.
Is there a way that we can get a list of what all those specific people will be?
There's a law that actually passed that outlines that.
Mm-hmm. It's on the council website. I know we've had it here before and disseminated it to the public. We can locate that again and put it on our website.
Put it on the newsletter.
And it was in the newsletter?
I said maybe we can also put it in the newsletter.
And put it in the newsletter, perhaps.
So just wanted to point then about the motion. I'm assuming it's okay if there's a particular meeting where Dr. Miles can't be there, and then we just draw from our two alternates, so it doesn't require any of the four of us, as long as we have the quorum for the meeting, if you will.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? Ready for the vote? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstention? The motion carries, and I do realize I overlooked Wizard General Vincent. All right, thank you.
So what I'll recommend is, and I mean, we can firm this up offline, but perhaps we can have our first meeting before next month's executive session. It would be here, and then the group can talk about how they think they would like to proceed, and at that time we can talk a little bit more about lab and what we're ready to do or not do, and how we want to approach the pharmacy regulations. And I think we also want to be clear the difference between the Board of Pharmacy regulations and the pharmaceutical control regulations. I know sometimes there's some confusion and overlap in conversation, so we want to get that clear delineation.
Would you like any input, Alan, in terms of the full board's thoughts about the idea of sure, prioritize five particular items or do it from start to finish in terms of the review part? I don't know if you wanted feedback. You mentioned that. I don't know if you wanted feedback or not about how people feel.
I'm always open to feedback. I don't know, since this is the first sit, I think the rest of the board members are hearing about this, whether any thoughts been given to any particular regulations that people feel we should prioritize. And certainly if there's something that you feel that we need to move on that's kind of out of date, we can consider that. Or if not, I think the committee, when they get together, can kind of talk about and share their thoughts about the best approach and then come back to the board and get some input at that point.
Maybe council has thoughts too about anything that she senses could require attention sooner rather than later as well. I want to express it now, but welcome that input.
And I would say too, Mr. Appleby, that we could start with one approach, for example, if we wanted to start from A and go to Z, but if in the course of conversation something is highlighted that either impacts the public or a particular board member identifies an issue that maybe we need to prioritize, we could always fit that in, mm-hmm. and it gives us the flexibility.
Okay. I think it's important. I'm glad that the subcommittee is going to take a look at it. More than likely, the approach of prioritizing will probably be the direction. I would be surprised if it would be otherwise, only because as the practice is changing, as there's more collaboration across the different professions, I'm sure maybe there's some regulations that stand out and might have higher priority. But as you take a look at that, then I guess it does make sense. Either we'll go from A to Z or we'll kind of prioritize the the top ones.
Right. I think the one thing we have to be careful about, and this is where Carla can really help us, is when you change the regulations, oftentimes, and we saw this with collaborative practice, oftentimes it then impacts language in other regulations. So in terms of that coordination and being mindful of, so we don't go back and unnecessarily change things.
And that's why I think not only Carla, but also Executive Director Shauna taking a look at the big picture and seeing maybe what are the regs that we need to look at more, because I think about nursing and how our regs can impact not only medicine but also nursing, and maybe there's some chatter that, you know, that's been overheard with some of the other boards that we might take into consideration.
So one of the things I'll do is go through other laws, because not necessarily something that came from the board, but I think you may recall the naloxone legislation passed. And that actually, that's in effect now, right? And that's something that affects this board, because it's the one that allows pharmacists to basically prescribe. So we need to look at that as well. And I think we needed to put some training requirements in place.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. Let's talk about naloxone for a second. Is it your, and I don't know, maybe you might not be prepared to answer, so I won't put you on the spot, but should there be pharmacists in D.C. who are furnishing naloxone without a prescription right now?
I believe right now they're waiting on us some sort of training or something in place.
Right. So I asked the question because it may be occurring, and my understanding from the regulations is that the department has to create training requirements. The pharmacists will be required to counsel, but they also have to go through a training program if they're going to furnish without a prescription. And the counseling points and the training points are very clearly outlined in the law. So whether the board then has to further promulgate regulations or the department does, I think we have to talk about. But I think there's a difference between allowing pharmacists to furnish without a prescription based on the law versus doing it under the auspices of, the technical language just left my mind, but essentially it's to protect the pharmacist from liability. So if they see an urgent need, something's happening, somebody is ODing in front of them, that they can administer and they're protected, and it's called Good Samaritan law. So my understanding is that they should not be furnishing routinely under the guise of Good Samaritan. It's not the purpose of Good Samaritan. If it was, there would be no need to introduce this legislation.
So that's another one we need to look at, because I believe we do have a piece of number we need to write to.
Okay.
So just real quickly, there was a question from the audience, and I did pull up the bill about clinical labs. So the professions will be the practice of cytotechnology, histotechnology, medical technology, cytotechnologists, histologic technicians, histotechnologists, medical laboratory technicians, medical technologists, and phlebotomists. So,
did you get all that, Don?
No.
So basically, those that work like in the path lab, the pathology lab, like your histologists and things like that, in addition to like your phlebotomists.
Right. So the law number, if you want to look it up on council's website, the law number is L20-272, and you can pull up the law.
I guess my question is, so what is it that you're going to actually be responsible for all those?
Licensing and regulating those professions.
Well, here's the thing that's going to be kind of crazy, perhaps. Your mission statement lists the people, you know, like five groups, so you're going to have to add those groups to it?
We will. Okay. Just like we had technicians recently.
And how we added detailers, you know, pharmacists. Hey, we serve. All right. Anything else?
No, but I do think we need to be ready, perhaps. Yeah, we need to start discussing naloxone. Because we don't want to impede the intention of the legislation, and that is to enhance access where appropriate. And so hopefully, and we know that there's a fairly bureaucratic process that has to be adhered to in terms of promulgating regulations, but I'd like to not see the holdup be on our end. So if we can move as swiftly as possible, Knox, I think that would benefit our professionals and the public.
That one might be one of our first.
Yeah, I think so.
So I'm going to piggyback, Alan, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So we have some pharmacists in the audience, and so I'm using my telepathy and reading minds. Some pharmacists in the audience has a question, and that question is, as of right now today, what can a pharmacist in D.C. do as it relates to naloxone under the current law and regulation? What can they be doing? Right now you got a pharmacist operating right down the street and there's something that happens right in front of them. What are they allowed to do right now without getting in trouble?
So they can fill a prescription for naloxone, a prescription from a licensed prescriber.
And if they don't have a prescription, they should not be doing any of that.
They should not be furnishing without a prescription.
Gotcha. Just
should not be furnishing without a prescription.
Not right now. Not yet.
Not yet. Even in the case of an emergency like the Good Samaritan.
So, right. So if you see somebody that's in distress, or you're concerned that somebody may be ODing, that's, I think, the purpose of the Good Samaritan law. But just to have consumers come into the pharmacy to say, I'd like to just have some at home just in case, that's furnishing without a prescription, and I think that's the intent of the new law that passed. So one should not just be routinely furnishing until the regulations are created and approved.
Good
and
stuff.
That's our committee report. Thank you.
So the next item is the communication subcommittee report. I think, you know, you guys just gave us some good information. Our newsletter is published quarterly, and so I think the edition came out in March. And so I can't think of the exact date of the next one, but in a few more months, it will be time for us to publish another one. There's some good information that's already been mentioned that we probably want to make sure we include in the newsletter. Information especially about the naloxone issue, pharmaceutical detailer, as that kind of comes about, whatever changes are made with that, as well as the information about the additional health professionals that the Board of Pharmacy is now tasked with overseeing the licensure of. And so right now we are simply looking at content that we will include in the upcoming newsletter feature, and we're just happy to get the ball rolling. Especially want to thank every single member of this Board of Pharmacy, because even if you weren't on the or aren't on the subcommittee, your energy and your suggestions, your thought and your constant push to get us back going was really helpful. So it's much appreciated.
Madam Chair, I just want to acknowledge the members of the Communications Committee, Mr. Curry, Mr. Bellegarde, and yourself. Thank everybody.
Yeah.
So I know that, you know, the board's been talking for quite a period of time about putting together a newsletter, and just really appreciate the time that everybody in the committee took to put together, I think, a good piece of information. Coupling that with NAPP, it's definitely helpful to our pharmacists and our technicians, and potentially to our drug manufacturer representatives as well. So thank you all for that.
I think it's good information. Yeah, so we're happy that that's going again. So next item on our agenda is a wonderful presentation that we're about to get from our pharmacy interns. And so I am going to turn things over and allow our interns to come up so that they can... Okay, our intern to come up for the presentation.
Thank you.
Don't forget to introduce yourself again.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to say welcome. My name is Efren Abara, first year pharmacy student from Howard University. And my presentation will focus on four important points that I've already picked up from the National Association of Border Pharmacy news update. I'll be doing a summary on those four important points. So, like I said, this presentation will focus on those four areas. So I have listed on these four objectives. The first one is to identify the strategies and significance of controls and stance policy initiatives. Here we have two important elements that I'll be focusing on. One is to talk about those policy initiatives which are adopted by the states. And then I'll try to look at the significance or the implications of those policy initiatives. And then I will describe the compliance and enforcement mechanisms of prescription drug monitoring programs. Here, I know a lot of you know what this program is, so I'm not going to go in detail talking about what this program is, but rather I'll be focusing on how states conduct their PDMPs in terms of different points. We'll get to that when we get to that slide. And I'll also talk about some of the enforcement mechanisms, again, which are adopted by the states, the reason why they need to have these enforcement mechanisms, and what are they. And then I'll talk about the possible cause for non-transmission or late transmission with regard to the prescription drug monitoring program. And then I'll talk about some of, I'll put forward some recommendations with that respect. And then the other article that I was somewhat very much interested in is the acetaminophen awareness coalition report. Here what we're gonna see is what are the goals of the AAC, the acetaminophen awareness coalition. And they have done some research and they came up with some common dosing mistakes that patients often do, which make them more liable to this acetaminophen overdose. So what are those common dosing mistakes? And then what does the report come up with? So there, I'll go through some of their findings. And then there are some health tips which are recommended by the AAC. I'll go through them. And then finally, there is labeling change for all testosterone products, which is required or requested by the FDA. And then what are those labeling changes? And then I'll go through that. So this is, you can call it the first chapter. It talks about the strategies and significance of controlled substance policy initiatives. And this slide, I just picked up some of the policy initiatives which are adopted by the states, like I said earlier, to address this growing problem. So one of the policy initiatives which is being introduced by the states is expanding access to naloxone without prescription. I know I should have asked Sir earlier. He was explaining to us, like, what do pharmacists do whenever they have a patient. So I thought you were saying that they're not supposed to do anything without prescription, right? Yeah, so are they allowed to do so when if it's like opioid overdose? If we have a patient who's suffering from opioid overdose, are we allowed to dispense to naloxone without prescription?
Yes, so my understanding is if there's a patient that is suffering from an overdose, the Good Samaritan law does allow and protect pharmacist or physician, or I think even like fire department, you know, the individuals and other services can administer under those extreme circumstances.
Without prescription.
Without a prescription, but just in an emergency.
Thank you very much. Actually, that's what's being practiced by many states, that allowing pharmacists to dispense naloxone without prescription. Like said, some other states, like including the South Dakota, they are allowing their first respondents also to administer naloxone without prescription. So this is one of the policy initiatives which is being used by the states to address this growing problem. The second policy initiative is implementing effectively the prescription drug monitoring program. The next chapter I have, I'll be discussing about this issue in depth, so I get back to that. Provider education, this is giving special training for healthcare providers, especially for us pharmacists who don't get a chance to administer certain drugs while we are at school. So once we get out of school, we need to have those trainings. How do we administer medications in the IV form or if it is intranasal, which is, I think, in 2015, we have this naloxone that came in terms of intranasal. So we can easily administer that. So we need to have those special trainings. So that's also another policy initiatives which has been put in place by the states. Mandatory prescription drug testing laws. This one, it goes a little bit rough, I would say, like it requires patients to have this drug test, especially for those patients who are in a long-term therapy, for those who are taking these opioid prescriptions for more than 90 days. Some of the states that enacted, I know the district, I don't think they have this law, but some of the states like Indiana, Kentucky, Washington, and Tennessee, they have already enacted this law. They require those patients in a long-term therapy to have drug tests, especially if they are going to stay on those medications for more than 90 days. So what we see in here is some of, I'm not saying these are the only policy initiatives, we do have a lot. But for the sake of our discussion, I merely focus on these policy initiatives, which I believe are very important to address this growing problem. What are the significance of these policy initiatives? If you go back to the previous slides, I merely focus on, if you look at the policy initiatives, they merely focus on naloxone, on opioid overdose. But here, what the FDA is requiring is, wait a minute, that's not the only problem that we have. There are other class of medications that have high potential for abuse that we need to take into consideration as well. For example, benzodiazepines. In some states, like Massachusetts, they have also included gabapentin in here as well. So we do have these medications that have high potential for abuse, and they should be taken into consideration as well, especially when we are concurrently administering these two medications at the same time. So what the FDA is requiring is, when we give these two medications at the same time, the prescriber should alert the patient about the possible black box warning associated with these medications. Like, I already listed down here. And the other significance of these policy initiatives is it's encouraging more inspection by the board just to make sure that these controlled substances are prescribed and they are dispensed properly. But above all, the very important objective behind all this initiative is to save people's life. And what the research, what we find out from all this research is that as a result of this policy change, especially in those states who enacted those laws and then who put them in place, we have a reduced morbidity and mortality rates associated with opioid overdose, so which is something that we all need to cheer. And this is the second chapter. I mean, like I said, I think there are four chapters. This is the second chapter. It's all about prescription drug monitoring programs. Like I said earlier, I'm not gonna stand here and lecture you about what PDMP means. That would be a crime for me. But what I'm trying to show to you is, one of the things in here is, I know states, they carry out their own PDMPs. There's no, like, as far as my understanding is concerned, there is no any PDMP which is run by the government. So states have their own PDMPs. So one of the things about this is that these PDMPs, they're organized and operated differently across the states. In terms of, let's say for example, which drugs are monitored by PDMP. All the states, they don't include the same medication in their PDMPs. I can give you some examples. If you take like 16 states, including Virginia, they include only from Schedule 2 to Schedule 4 medication in their PDMPs. Whereas if you look at all the rest, 36 states, including the districts, they include both Schedule 2 to Schedule 5 medication. So that's where you see one difference as to how these states conduct their business. The frequency of data collection. How often should the data be collected? There you see another big difference. For example, most of the states around this area, if you take about Maryland, Virginia, the district, I know the district is not states. So all this, they collect data on daily basis. Whereas if you talk about Oregon, Pennsylvania, then they do it every 72 hours. Still other states like California and Florida, they do it on weekly basis. So you can see how states collect data differs. With regard to who may request patient information, again, this is one of the areas where we see those differences. For example, in the districts, the licensing board, patients, they do have the right to request those information. But if you go to Connecticut, neither the licensing board nor the patient has the right to request the data from the PDMP. As far as the enforcement mechanism is concerned, this is something that I'm going to discuss in the next slide. Now, when we go to the enforcement mechanisms, I'd like to raise two questions. The first one is, why do we need to have these enforcement mechanisms? Why do the states need to put these enforcement mechanisms? And the second one is, what are they? Now, when we ask ourselves why, the answer would be very simple. The states, they adopt or they put in place these enforcement mechanisms to promote consistent use of the program and also to encourage their practitioners to fully engage and participate in the program. That's the reason why they have to put on enforcement mechanisms. I know many people, for us professionals, that would be okay, but for patients, they won't take it easy if you have to enforce them to do anything, right? Let alone, mandatory drug test, even mandatory health care is not a problem, right? People don't like it. So, but these states, they have to do it just to make sure that this program is put in place effectively. So what are some of the enforcement mechanisms which are being adopted by the states? As of May 2016, this is the data that I have. It requires practitioners to refer to a patient's PDMP if, before they write prescription for these cover substances, if they have a legitimate concern that the patient might not be using these substances effectively, or they might be abusing them, or they might be using them for something else other than for their medical condition. So during that, then the prescriber, by the law, they are required to obtain a patient's PDMP. Some states, they go even further by passing a law for comprehensive prescriber use mandates. Some of the states are like Kentucky, New York, Ohio, Connecticut, and Maine. They have already have this law. What it says is a prescriber, regardless of his personal judgment. What I've said earlier was he has to use his professional judgment. But in here, regardless of his personal professional judgment, when a prescriber writes prescription for cover substances, initially, he has to refer to the patient's PDMP, regardless. So this is more mandatory for the prescriber. The last enforcement mechanism is interstate data sharing. 46 states, except Florida, Georgia, Missouri, and Nebraska. Actually, Missouri, they don't have PDMP, so you can just leave them out. But the rest states, they don't authorize interstate data sharing. Even those who have this law who allow interstate data sharing, there are some exceptions. Like, for example, Oregon, they share only with a couple of states, like Washington State, California, Idaho, and Nevada. If you go to Iowa, they allow interstate sharing only with bordering states and Kansas. But still, the good thing is we do have these 46 states that allow interstate data sharing. And here I'll be discussing about the possible causes for non-transmission or latent transmission. Now, for a number of reasons, practitioners, sometimes they fail to report on time. If they have to do it within a 24-hour period, they may not do it. And the reason for this possible non-transmission or late transmission is exemptions. Many states, they exempt their dispensers from reporting under certain conditions. Now the question is, what are these conditions? If it is like, for example, a hospital or a nursing facility that provides service for inpatients, then they don't have to do it. If it is a correctional facility, again, they will be exempted. If they don't dispense controlled substance, then they don't have to report. Or if there is like a natural disaster, again, they will be exempted from reporting. But I do have some recommendations to overcome this. What we need to do is the PDMP guideline, it should set a time limit for which the exemption is valid for. What it means is whenever these institutions are granted for waiver, then they don't have to do it like forever. It should be temporary. It should be for some time. Thus requiring the dispenser to reapply for an exempt. What it does is it gives the regulators to do some inspection before they renew their exempts. And the other recommendation could be requiring the dispenser to notify the PDMP if their status changes. This is to mean, like, for example, if the dispenser doesn't dispense controlled substance, then they will be exempted. But once they start dispensing those products, then they will be, they will no longer be eligible. So we can take those recommendations as well. The other possible cause could be lack of knowledge. This is true especially when it comes to, like, if it is a new pharmacy, if it is a new pharmacist, if it is out-of-state pharmacy, then they may not comply. So what are the recommendations? We have to provide detailed information concerning any change. I'm talking about the PDMPs or the licensing boards. They have to provide detailed information concerning any change to the existing laws and regulations. If there is any law, then we have to inform the providers. And we have to, the PDMP and the licensing or regulatory agencies, they need to have a link on their websites that makes it whatever information they have, that will be available to the providers. The licensing testing, this is what I found also very interesting. Every time a dispenser applies to obtain or renew a license, then they have to take a licensing test. By doing so, you can just keep them updated, and then you can make sure that they're on the right track. I'm not saying these are the only causes for late transmission or for non-transmission. You can, technology could be also a factor. There might be some internet issue, the computer could crash. Sometimes there are willful non-compliance. Sometimes dispenser, they deliberately do not comply. So we have to take all those factors into consideration as well. This is the third chapter that I picked up. It's about acetaminophen awareness coalition report. In this country, every week, more than 50 million people, they take medication that has acetaminophen. And we have more than 600 over-the-counter acetaminophen medications. So
you can imagine how they can easily be susceptible to this acetaminophen overdose. So the AAC, the Acetaminophen Awareness Coalition, the main goal of the AAC is to increase consumer awareness about the safe use of acetaminophen and also to prevent unintentional acetaminophen overdose. Now, the AAC, they have done some research and they came up with some common dosing mistakes that patients often do that could result in acetaminophen overdose. One of the common dosing mistake that was suggested is taking the next dose too soon. Usually, those medications that have acetaminophen in them, we give them like as a pain medication. So what patients often they do is you tell them to take one medication every 6 hours, but they take one, and then by the time they wake up, if they don't feel okay, and then they'll just simply take the other pill. So by doing so, they could end up having this overdose. Using multiple acetaminophen-containing products at the same time, you can imagine, like, if you don't happen to be in a pharmacy school or in other healthcare facility, as a layperson, it will be very difficult for patients to know whether a certain medication has acetaminophen or not. So because they don't know that those medications have acetaminophen, then they will end up taking 2-3 medications at a time that will result in acetaminophen overdose. Taking more than the recommended dose, so these are some of the common dosing mistakes that patients often do that will result in overdose. So what does the coalition report says? All the efforts made by the AAC has brought a significant impact when it comes to consumers or patients' understanding of this problem. Unintentional acetaminophen exposures have declined since 2019. Consumers' understanding of the possible side effects associated with acetaminophen has increased from 78% in 2010 to 87% in 2013. Number of consumers who think that it's very important to check the drug label for maximum daily dose has also increased. So what we see in here from the report is that the AAC has done a tremendous job, especially in creating this understanding and knowledge about the acetaminophen overdose. So some of the health tips which are recommended by the AAC, it includes patients are encouraged to read and follow the label. They should know which medications contain acetaminophen. They have to take only one medicine at a time that contains acetaminophen. Then they should be encouraged to ask their healthcare provider and their pharmacist about the dosing instructions or medicines that contain acetaminophen. So by doing so, we can alleviate the problem. This is the last chapter for this presentation. It's about labeling change to all testosterone products. These are some of the prescription testosterone products that we have in the market. Again, I'm not saying these are the only ones, but the most common ones that we have in the market. This is the pre-existing safety labeling that we find in most in all testosterone products. Change in blood pressure, change in lipid profile, fluid retention with or without congestive heart failure. All these are what we found in the pre-existing labels. But the question is, what are those new changes that the FDA is now warning? These are the two important elements that the FDA wants to incorporate in the new labeling. One is the abuse potential of these testosterone products. What they found out is that most patients who use these products, they ended up becoming more dependent on these products. So the FDA is now warning that this abuse potential of these testosterone products should be indicated. And also mental health. So those are the two important changes that the FDA wants to highlight in this labeling change as far as testosterone products are concerned. before I move on to the questions, I was having something in my mind, like one of the, I have read one article very recently. I believe some of you might be familiar. So I would just, I'd like to put that point out for you for a little discussion. So the Maryland legislators, this is what came out just last month, March 30. The Maryland legislators, they have already proposed, I don't think it passed, I mean, it's not, they didn't vote for it. But what they have proposed is to use marijuana, like I was suggesting naloxone, they are also suggesting to use marijuana for opioid overdose. So how do you see that? So I just want to open this for discussion.
You want to
ask
questions
about your presentation first? Yes, okay. Before I move on to that, let me take your questions and comments. Yes, sir.
So first, just a comment. Thank you very much for the presentation. That was really good. I wish we had put in for CE.
Thank you.
So one question, one comment. So my question is, for the last piece on the testosterone products, are the labeling changes now in place, or is the FDA recommending these changes and asking for public comment?
From what I've read, it's not like the FDA asking for the public comment, but it's warning the manufacturers and the dispensers to alert their patients about the abuse potential and the mental health issue. So from my understanding, it's not like asking for the public for the opinion, but rather they have already credible evidence that these products, they have this potential, and then the mental health issue. So what they're saying is the manufacturers, as well as the dispensers, they have to warn, they have to alert their patients about these effects.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then my comment is related to the prescription drug monitoring programs, and you talked about some states also, beside mentioning opioids, benzodiazepines. And so we have two neighboring jurisdictions, Maryland and Virginia, mm-hmm. that both tie in the use of benzos with opioids as well. And with respect to gabapentin, you mentioned the importance of that. Virginia just added that as a drug of concern. So in DC, we report butalbital and cyclobenzaprine. In Virginia now, they're adding gabapentin, and I think tramadol is a drug of concern for them as well. So one of the challenges I think that the PDMPs can probably do a little bit better at is, just in my opinion, outlining the allowances for sharing information, because that seems to be where folks struggle. How can I use the information that I obtained through the PDMP? Can a pharmacist share it with the physician? Can a physician share it with another physician? What if it's a pain panel, for example, that isn't necessarily prescribing for the patient, but could be overseeing care and making recommendations to the prescriber? Verbally, you can share certain things, but apparently in writing, you can't. And some states don't allow you to cut and paste from the PDMP, but you can give an alert and put perhaps in the pharmacy record, check the PDMP. Some states allow you to actually document in the medical record. A prescriber can, but a pharmacist can't. Some states don't allow that because they're concerned about liability and discoverability. And if you put it in the medical record, it's discoverable, and so they don't want law enforcement to get it that way. So a lot of this seems to be unclear, and there doesn't seem to be consistency throughout the jurisdictions. And I'm hoping that, you know, going forward, as every year clarity is provided at the legislative level for PDMPs, that this is one area that will be better addressed. Because at the end of the day, it's about patient care. And people need the information to make informed decisions.
That's true.
So thank you again for your presentation.
Thank you. I absolutely agree with that. Actually, when I was preparing the presentation, when I was thinking how those states conduct their business differently, their PDMPs differently, what gets to my mind is, like I said in the presentation, there's any federal system, but for the fact that each state conduct their PDMPs differently, it will make it very difficult even to share data. Like one state they just provide only schedule 2 to 4, whereas the others, they include 5. Still, they do have also other restrictions as well. That would make it very difficult to work across states. So absolutely, I agree with you.
Well, it's also important, too, for looking at neighboring jurisdictions, because people who abuse will simply cross the state line.
Yeah.
So to just kind of align the effort, I think, enhances the advantages of the PDMA.
Okay, now that's true. Do you think that we need to have some centralized government system? Maybe just to check. This question is to you all. I'm not just only to him. But do you think we need to have some centralized system that would manage and control this, data sharing among states?
The data sharing is shared among many states. So you can go into one state and you can see other states. So there's like a consortium, but not everybody's sharing. So I think we're moving towards that. Whether the laws and regulations will all be aligned, the states are so far deep in it now, I think that would be a struggle, but who knows?
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I agree with Friedman. Excellent presentation.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask if you know what the sharing is within the district. How many states is there data sharing with for the PDMP here in the district?
Let me say something.
You want me to answer the question?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. So right now we're sharing with about 13 states. So we have more to come online, but there is a process that has to be, there's a process that has to go through before we can share information. Each state has different rules about who can and who cannot see the data. So from a practitioner perspective, from a delegate perspective, so we have to sit down with each jurisdiction and discuss based on their rules and regulations and then come to an agreement, and then we can start sharing data. So it's a slow process, but definitely we are sharing with the neighboring jurisdiction. So we hope to be sharing with everyone at one point in time, at some point in time in the future, but as of right now, our priority is the states on the East Coast, all the way up during the 95 corridor.
So then specifically, do we have Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania, Delaware? Do we have those?
Right, we do not have Pennsylvania yet.
We don't.
Yeah. But if you are registered with the prescription drug monitoring program, you can go in there and see all the states that you can pull data from.
I have a question.
Yes.
So how you're saying that you get a few other states PDMP. So if you're in DC and you're looking at another state, do the laws apply like communication wise with other prescribers? Does it apply to, are you looking at the laws of the state where you're looking at, or are you always gonna use the DC laws for the PDMP?
Great question.
So I just want you to rephrase that one more time. You're saying, so if you're practicing, if you're practicing in the District of Columbia, you'll always follow District of Columbia.
So you don't have to follow the rules of the other state.
Well, if you're practicing in DC, you're accountable for District of Columbia law.
Okay, so that's all you have to do. All right.
Okay. Any questions? Any additional questions? Thank you, Ephraim. You did a great job.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I
agree
with Alan. We definitely should have gotten two.
We can do it.
We actually can. All right. Thank you so much for that great presentation. So now we're going to move on. For the sake of time, I just wanted to mention a couple of things that I think might be of interest to this audience. Just some news going around in our neighboring states, a couple of things that might be of interest. In Maryland, on March the 1st, there was an announcement where the governor declared a emergency to combat opioid and heroin epidemic. And essentially, and you probably saw some of this on the news, but basically it looks like about $50 million over 5 years is going to be dedicated to kind of combat opioid and the heroin epidemic. It's interesting because in 2016, almost 1,500 people in Maryland alone died from heroin and fentanyl. And that's just in the first 9 months of 2016. So it's like 1,400, almost 1,500 just from heroin and fentanyl. It's important for us to understand, because I think when we're talking to pharmacists, the first thing I think of is, how is this applicable to what we do in pharmacy, how we practice? A lot of the money that you're going to see states throwing at this epidemic is going to go towards law enforcement. And I just wanted to make that very clear, because a lot of the problems that we're having with this kind of prescription drug abuse is from illicit distribution of it. So maybe your auntie got a prescription, but someone even outside of the family, a neighbor or your or her son's friend came over and is actually using or actually put it on the street. So I just wanted to point that out. So kudos, it's great that there's more attention and more funding being targeted to the epidemic, but just keep in mind there's a split, there's a distribution in how some of those funds will go about. Another thing I think this for this audience as pharmacists, gabapentin. I think back in 2011, 2010, we started getting word of individuals who were abusing Neurontin. Go figure. A lot of this came about because of what was happening in the prisons. So there were inmates who were prescribed gabapentin because of seizures or neuropathy or whatever. And what they were finding is probably only 15% of the inmates who it was prescribed to actually had it on hand when their cells were checked. What was happening is other inmates were taking it and crushing it and snorting it. And when you ask individuals who misuse gabapentin, what kind of buzz do you get from that? They describe it as, some people kind of say it feels like a mellowed out marijuana vibe, or some people call it like a zombie state. But the point is, this is getting a lot of increased attention, especially with what's going on with some of the other drugs that are more popular with abuse. There's some states even looking at whether or not they need to reschedule gabapentin. So just be on the lookout for that. So the information that came out in March was about Ohio, but this is something that's been going on in other places as well. Something else that might be of interest to this group, TTP. Remember during the presidential campaign, and there was a lot of talk about TTP and who's for it, who's against it. Well, guess what? I never even looked up what the whole details of that was about. But there's something about it that might be kind of interesting to pharmacists, because as a part of TTP, something that did pass in March, but it will go into effect in November, is the EU and the US finally agreed to accept each other's inspections of manufacturing companies. So if you are a manufacturing company and you have drugs that go to the US or places in the EU, those two countries are going to respect those inspection reports. And that way you don't have to do more duplicate inspections. So their thought is it's going to lower costs because you don't have to repeat some of this. They have similar standards anyway, and so it kind of just makes sense for them to do that. But I thought it was interesting because it was all on that whole TTP thing. Okay, maybe two more things for this group that might be interesting. Up our way in New York. So similar to Maryland, de Blasio has committed to increase funding towards opioid abuse as well. But instead of $50 million, his, I think, was like $30 or $38 million that will be distributed. But get this, is like $38 million a year, not $38 million over 5 years, $38 million a year. And again, a lot of this is going to go towards other things. Like, for example, he wants an increase in methadone treatment for addicts, because the idea is that if you can treat them better as addicts, then maybe they'll be less likely to get addicted to some other substance. So so New York is increasing their funding in those for those things as well. And then the last thing is just the fluoroquinolone. The FDA actually made changes to the labeling of fluoroquinolone back in May 2016, almost a year ago. However, there are a few things, and I won't go over the other ones, but if you're interested, you can go on the FDA's website. Now there's a webinar that they just launched to inform the public about the change in the fluoroquinolone labeling. And so that's really just what that's about. And so for my pharmacy students in the audience, Just as a reminder, because I'm sure you probably learned this in school, so you know based on this new labeling, if there's acute bacterial sinusitis, acute bacterial bronchitis, and uncomplicated UTI, fluoroquinolones are not considered first-line treatment. And in the labeling, they included the information about the damage to the muscles, the tendons, and that kind of thing. So all this is now they want more awareness of it, so the FDA put some webinars out there, so you're free to check those things out. And I think just for the sake of this audience, those are kind of just the things that I just wanted to reinforce and make sure that you're aware of. All right. Not sure if DC is increasing a lot of funding about this whole heroin and opioid epidemic. I'm sure it's probably being discussed or something like that. I don't know. Yeah, great.
So we currently the Pharmaceutical Control Division is working with other agencies. We have a $300,000 grant from the CDC.
Okay.
We're working with our DBH partners and our EPI partners to exchange, see what resources that we have for data sharing, and the grant is for 3 years, so we're using that grant to kind of take advantage of our resources here. And we also, the Director of Department of Health heads a heroin task force, and that task force is comprised of probably about 14 other agencies. I probably can give maybe like 6 or 7 off the top of my head, but that includes the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner, the Department of Behavioral Health, our EPI department. We also have some DEA representatives at that meeting, as well as our HIV, AIDS, Hepatitis, STD department. And we get pop-ins and pop-outs. We have our general counsel's office there, our Office of Attorney General's office. So the meeting is held once a month. It's the internal meeting, and we definitely discuss trends that we are seeing in the district for drug overdose and abuse. So there are things happening here.
Okay, good.
I want to just also reiterate that Howard University College of Pharmacy has piloted a training program for pharmacy students and pharmacists in the administration of naloxone and the treatment of opioid dependence and abuse. So be on the lookout for us to expand that program. So right here in D.C., you will be able to, you know, become more educated and certified.
Okay.
Yes.
Totally different topic.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if we have an update on our plans to prepare for the regional or district meeting
mm-hmm.
in 2018.
Good question. Actually, I probably should have mentioned that in the communications thing. Maybe this is a better time. So just as a reminder, in 2018, the District of Columbia is hosting the District 1 and 2 regional meeting right here. So we'll have our neighboring boards from Maryland, Virginia, D.C., Connecticut, Rhode Island, and New York.
New Jersey.
I feel like I'm leaving somebody out. So they will all be coming here. I think we're thinking maybe about 200 attendees, and we are really excited. In 2017, right now what we're doing is we're sitting in on the planning calls for Connecticut, because Connecticut is hosting it in September, October of 2017. So it's really helpful for us to kind of sit in, listen to the planning. We know what organizations usually commit funding for some of the efforts. We know what CE topics are really of keen interest that we might want to include when we host it in 2018. Right now, we're trying to nail down the suggested dates that NABP would like for us to consider hosting the meeting. NABP, they kind of tell the organizer a couple of windows to host the meeting that are pretty ideal. And so we're still waiting for the 2018 dates to come back from NABP. And then once we have that, we will start to look for venues. Very shortly, we need to put together like a planning committee that will consist of board and staff here for DC, so that a lot of the logistics can be worked out. We're ahead of the game so far, but we are actively involved in the planning for 2017 so that we'll be fully prepared for 2018. So just wanted to let you know, we're super excited about that. Once again, we've hosted it before, it's been years ago. People are pretty excited to come to DC, and we're excited to have them. The dinners, the entertainment, the souvenirs, the things that we want to make sure we provide, we want to make sure that they capture the essence of DC. And so be on the lookout for that. So I was just telling them, the most recent call was actually last week. And we have about, I would say we have a conference call maybe once a month. This was our third call. And so, yeah, right now the majority of that conversation centered around the CE, the planning for the CEs for 2017.
So I just would want to mention the factor of time, and if we have to go through an approval process, making sure that we don't get too far down the track and get in a time crunch. So, for example, we know we have to pick a date. We know we need to pick a hotel and conference rooms. And the question about money and whether DC is going to be contributing funds or not, I don't know what the approval process is for any of this, but if it's going to take a long time to get approval, I'd hate for us to get into a crunch where we don't know what we need to know by when we need to know it. That's all.
Okay, sure. So thank you. To answer this question, I think Dr. Renard forgot. This meeting is in conjunction with AACP, the American right. Colleges of Pharmacy. Because we are a government agency, the meeting is structured so with NABP and AACP. So that is how that's going to work. I don't think we will be providing some support, but DC government, Department of Health won't be like sponsoring necessarily the conference, if that's what you're asking. As far as the date, NABP is going to tell us a few dates, and then we'll select from that date, but that date has to come from NABP because they have several regional conferences going on at the same time, and some of their staff that's headquartered in Chicago has to attend every meeting,
right.
So they want to be respectful to their schedules and not have the meetings back to back to back to back to back. They're usually over a course of about 2 months, so once they give us a few dates and we see what's available, we'll go from there. But we work in conjunction with the NABP team and AACP to kind of work out the logistics.
So in terms of funding?
Yes, so I can speak to that because that actually was discussed at the first planning meeting. There's a commitment, a sponsorship from a core group of entities like the manufacturing companies and then local pharmacies. So a lot of it is sponsorship in terms of covering some of the expense. The hotel part, people like register, and so in terms of money for that part, it usually isn't really required, but there will be the need for funding for things like, you know, dinners and entertainment or whatever, and then they've been covering that through sponsorship. So the good news is there's already a list of sponsors who routinely cover the district 1 and 2 meeting. We also want to add to that list because we have local companies that I think would be interested in providing sponsorship for that as well. And so that's where if there's funding that's needed, that's where it comes from for the most part.
Is someone from Virginia on those calls?
Yeah, Carolyn.
Yeah, because I remember her mentioning to me they had, and maybe it was through sponsorship, they raised X number of thousands of dollars in addition to, but I just didn't know if the DC government in any way, because it's Board of Pharmacy participation, was going to be asked to fund any money, and if so, I'm just concerned about what that approval process looks like.
Yeah, it looks like the DC government won't. And the good news also is, what's her name? Our deputy director.
Yeah.
Dr. Lewis. Yeah, she's very aware of the meeting and has offered her full support. That was actually brought up to the mayor, he's the chair of the health committee.
Right.
And he was very excited, and she mentioned the full support and that she's excited that DC is hosting it as well. So she's very supportive.
Okay.
But your point's well taken. Again, I there's nothing like planning, and sometimes you think you're so far ahead, and before you know it, you turn around and, oh, now you're behind the gun. So, yeah, I appreciate those questions. We'll continue with these calls. The main thing, Brad is going to get us that window of dates from NADP so that we'll know exactly what we have to work with. Then we need to get a venue. Shauna had a great idea in terms of we might want to get a hotel that's close to maybe around Union Station or something, because these are people who are coming from kind of close by. A lot of people might want to jump on a train instead of driving. So if we plan kind of around, like, Union Station or something like that in terms of hotels.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
But start thinking about, like, dinner places and entertainment, stuff like that, because we want to give them a really good experience. I feel like since we're in D.C., why not invite the only pharmacist who's in Congress to come and speak to our group, Carter from Georgia. Let's try to get him here. But, you know, we got some ideas. But as I mentioned, I think you might have stepped out, we're going to put together a very small planning committee to really work out all the fine details of this. So things are coming along. All right, so now it is that time where we get a chance to hear from our constituents, our stakeholders, our public members. So if there's anything that you'd like to bring before the board, any comments, any questions that you might have, now is the time. We simply ask that you stand, introduce yourself, and then provide whatever comments you wish to provide to the board. So taking all comments now.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Thomas. I'm with Delmarva Foundation, and we're the quality improvement organization for the District of Columbia. And what that means is that we work with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and trying to ensure the trust fund for Medicare and also the intention of the Health and Human Services projects that are moving forward to ensure health and safety and quality of our constituents, beneficiaries in the Medicare program. I wanted to let you all know that we have a program. I think this went out. Dr. White sent this out and to the board and licensed recipients. On April the 20th, we have a care coordination meeting. Dr. Kate Goodrich from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Quality and Safety Division will be our keynote. Dr. Romano from Sibley Memorial Hospital and Karen Sutherland will be our speakers. She's actually from South Carolina, and we'll talk about the IMPACT Act, which coordinates post-acute care centers and hospitals. We want to really invite pharmacy to attend because pharmacists are all part of this care coordination. There's more and more outreach to community pharmacies specifically. And if you want to have a voice in the process, please, you know, join the process in the meeting so that you can be heard. And your views are really important to be included. We're one of the only professions that are not incentivized. If we want to get provider status and incentivization, that's one of the ways to do it. So get involved. And here's some flyers. I have five or so to pass out, but that's it. Two things, though, I'd also like to say, based on your talk and comments about Dr. White about the heroin committee, we are actually reviewing adverse drug events in the district. Again, it's fee-for-service Medicare data, but we have some adverse drug event data that we're tracking every quarter from the claims data for opioid use. And if that's something of interest, I would certainly be willing to forward that to you if that would be something that was helpful. We're working with, again, pharmacies, doctor's offices, hospitals, nursing homes, providers, and those folks are getting those kind of reports if they're involved in our project. And also antibiotic stewardship that you mentioned, Dr. Bernard, about fluoroquinolone. So outpatient antibiotic stewardship is also part of our projects, and we are recruiting pharmacies to participate. To implement the four core elements of what CDC has identified as the core elements of stewardship. Pharmacists are really important in that. The issues with fluoroquinolones, use of antibiotics inappropriately in wrong times or other things. So, you know, if you're interested, and we can certainly share that with the board as well, but we want to include pharmacy to try to include pharmacy in all of the work that's happening. So, thank you.
I just want to, I know time is of the essence, but I just want to, I want to acknowledge the work that's coming out of Delmarva. As pharmacists, I don't know if we understand what's happening right now, and I'm concerned, I'm very concerned. I was just a part of a communication where there was a director of a hospital who reminded the billing group that, hey, pharmacists aren't providers, why are we talking about them even being involved in this whole care team and payment for service. This is 2017, and we're still having to demonstrate the value that we bring to the table. But it's only if we get involved. There are opportunities that are out there. You have organizations that are funded to help get us involved. We can only get provider status and really make collaborative practice function the way it's supposed to if we become recognized as providers. But guess what? We won't become recognized if we can't show our value. And so we can continue to sit silently if we want and watch other professions kind of continue to grow and expand. I won't even bring up the power behind nurses. I love nurses, they're great, but their political punch is powerful, especially when you compare it to pharmacists. We also want to acknowledge our physician colleagues, who unfortunately still in 2017 are still kind of wrestling to see us as key partners in healthcare. They're coming around, but for some of them it's a bitter pill to swallow. My point is this: understand that we will not get where we need to be until we step up to the plate. And stepping up to the plate means being involved in initiatives, documented interventions, being able to clearly show the value that our efforts bring to the table. So please take advantage of things like, you know, like what was just mentioned. Go and participate. Quite often, if you're in a clinic or in a hospital, you might be contacted to be a part of an effort to just submit your documentation so that we can track numbers and then be able to present it, you know, when we're asking for funding or when we're fighting for provider status. But, you know, pharmacy, you know, I would say pharmacists have come a long way, but it's interesting that we still have a ways to go. So I just wanted to acknowledge the work that you guys do and just really encourage people to just step up to the plate. Or, if we're not going to step up to the plate, sit back in our quiet silos and be quiet and accept it when we're dictated to in terms of how we need to practice. I'll get off my soapbox now. Thank you. Any other comments? This was really, really your time. It wasn't even my time. I apologize. Comments from the public. I saw at least one very, very familiar face come in the room who did not get a chance to introduce herself, and I think maybe there are about three others. So if you don't mind, if you came in and you didn't get a chance to state your name and what organization you might be affiliated with, please do so at this time. We'll start with the nice lady.
I'm Kim Greenwood. I'm one of the registered nurses from upstairs. I have to remember where I am. I'm from the immunization program.
And I just
agree, you all are leading immunization. So that's why I've been invited by Jennifer with Del Mar, because we're working on a partnership. We do a lot of different outreach activities to increase adult immunization. So thank you.
Very good, very good. Janice?
Yes, my name is Janice Jackson. I'm one of the pharmacists now in Hosta. So I just began looking forward to hopefully coming to more board meetings. Yeah, I've worked here for different agencies, but now I'm switching it to Hosta.
Good to see you again.
Nice.
The gentleman in the back, did you get a chance to introduce yourself?
I did.
I apologize. Is there anyone else who didn't get a chance to introduce yourself? No? All right. Thank you. Well, if that is it, then that will conclude our open session. We'll entertain a motion from one of our board members to close open session.
I move that we close the session of the Board of Pharmacy meeting. Thank you. Okay. Madam Chair, I move that the board close the open public session portion of the meeting and move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matters pursuant to 2-575B9, to seek the advice of counsel to the board, to preserve the attorney-client privilege, or to approve settlement agreements pursuant to 5-575.
Okay, thank you. There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Okay. Roll call vote. All in favor?
Roll call.
Yes. identify themselves if they vote in favor of the motion.
This is James Appleby. I vote in favor of the motion.
Okay.
Tamara McCants, I vote in favor of the motion.
Andy Curry, I vote in favor of the motion.
Alan Friedman, in favor.
Benjamin Miles, in favor of the motion.
Dr. Bernard, in favor of the motion. All right, so it looks like the motion passes. All right, thank you. See you. This is April.
June.
We'll see you in June. First Thursday of June.